confession of guilt to the charges of espionage. Will you sign it?
You think I'm going to sign a confession of guilt?
Boucher could not feel that her cotton shift was hanging open. The FBI agents tried not looking down the front of her cover-up. You're not being forced or coerced in any way to sign the document. I'm simply offering you the option, said Montgomery. Among her many flaws, Stephanie Boucher did not suffer from indecision. She believed in herself and had always thought that she deserved, no, it was owed her, the success, career, wealth, and lifestyle she now enjoyed. The fierce and greedy light that burned in her had long ago fired the conviction that she would not give ground to anyone for anything. That meant not letting these cake-eaters arrest her. That meant not losing the power and title and respect of elected office. That meant not going away forever to prison. She would not let that happen. She looked around at their faces.
Okay, I'll sign, she said abruptly.
The agents looked at one another. One stepped forward and took a pen out of his pocket. It was a white plastic Skillcraft pen with U.S. government stenciled on the side. Boucher looked at the pen and waved it off.
Missy, get my pen from the desk, she said.
Missy had been telephoning frantically and now walked over to the couch with Boucher's black and beige Mont Blanc étoile. Boucher unscrewed the cap, leaned over the paper, and scrawled something on the line at the bottom of the document. "This do it for you?" she asked. Montgomery took the document, looked at it, and smiled. "I'm not quite sure suck my dick would be admissible in court." "We'll do it any way you like," he said mildly.
"Who the hell is that guy?" she said, pointing at Nate.
A moment of awkward silence while all heads turned toward Nate. With the agent standing around the couch distracted, Boucher replaced the cap of her pen, grasped the pearl on the end of the pocket clip, drew out the copper-colored needle, and plunged it into a vein on her left arm. Nate was the only one who saw what she had done, and he leapt forward toward the couch, batting the pen out of her hand. None of the people in Boucher's living room had ever heard of the golden dart frog. Nor did they know that the 2-inch, bright yellow leaf-sitter lived exclusively in the Pacific Coast rainforest of Colombia. An FBI toxicologist with research materials at hand could have informed them that the toxin secreted from the skin of the tiny amphibian is highly lethal to humans, a neurotoxin that locks the muscles violently into a state of contraction, causing respiratory paralysis and heart failure. It was KGB chemists in Laboratory 12, the Camara, who first harvested the toxin in the 1970s after they discovered that there is no antidote for the poison and that the toxicity of the compound, as on the point of a treated needle, does not dissipate when dry or over time. The observed effects of the pinprick on Stephanie Boucher were less scientific and rather more spectacular. Her body convulsed massively, her legs involuntarily shot out straight, her toes pointed, and her limbs quivered uncontrollably. Boucher toppled flat onto the couch, her head flung back, the cords on her neck bulging, her eyes rolling wide into the sockets. Nate threw himself at her to hold her down by her jerking arms. Her hands formed rigid claws at her sides, and her lips were flecked with saliva. No sound came from her paralyzed larynx as she arched her back almost double. Nate cupped her chin in his hand and moved to resuscitate her.
"Better not, dude," said Proctor, the young SA eyeing the froth that had thickened around her lips. The men in the room stood looking down at her. She thrashed twice more and was still. Her cover-up had fallen open on one side, her breast exposed. Nate leaned over and covered her.
"Jesus," said Proctor. "You think it was the U.S. government pen?"
In the far corner of the room, Missy was whimpering. She now knew how this crazy day ended. Shrimp salad. Lightly boil peeled shrimp until tender firm. Finely dice scallions, celery, and Kalamata olives. Cube feta cheese and mix with mayonnaise, olive oil, cumin, fresh dill, and lemon juice. Add boiled shrimp, toss, and chill.
Chapter 36. Vanya Igorov sat behind the desk in his darkened office. Shades were drawn across the massive picture windows, his cigarette burned unattended in the ashtray. He was looking at the soundless picture of a flat-screen television in a credenza to one side of his desk. A news outlet from America was reporting a development. A Los Angeles reporter with blonde hair and pouty lips was standing in front of an ivy-covered gate on a tree-lined street. Behind him was superimposed the face of Senator Stephanie Boucher, a file photo from several years ago. The scrolling ticker of words along the bottom of the screen read, "California lawmaker dead at 45 of apparent heart attack." Swan, the most important asset for Russian intelligence in the last 5 decades. Gone. Heart attack. Nonsense. It was likely she had used the suicide pen Golov had requested and which Igorov himself had authorized. This was a nightmare. Who could have guessed that the Americans would so quickly identify her as the mole? And who would have predicted in this post-Cold War age of celebrity agents and politician spymasters that such a drastic, such a violent, such a Soviet conclusion to the Swan case would be played out? Igorov told himself that he had a narrow window to redemption. The CIA-directed mole was responsible for this costly loss. If Igorov could unmask him, he could salvage his position. There were at present only 2 options to pursue. The technical chief, Nasiryenko, implicated in the canary trap, and the traitor's CIA handler, Nash. Igorov pointed a remote control at the television to change channels. A clear color picture of Nasiryenko appeared on the screen. Every second of the multiple hours of his security interviews in the interrogation chambers of Butorkia had been filmed, and Igorov was coming to the same opinion voiced by Zhuganov, that the twitchy technician was incapable of acting as a CIA internal asset. The tapes showed the beatings, the drug-induced hysterics, Zhuganov leaning over his subject wearing some sort of military jacket. "Don't ask," thought Vanya. The relevant portion of the tape had been marked, and Igorov ran the counter forward to the spot. Nasiryenko numbly was admitting that he had spoken of the crushing backlog of work with the America's Department Chief General Vladimir Korchnoi. Korchnoi had offered to send him 2 analysts to ease the workload. Nasiryenko had showed Korchnoi one of the disks during the conversation. No, he had not inventoried the disks after that conversation. Yet by the investigator's count, 1 disk was missing, misplaced. No, it was ridiculous to think Korchnoi would have taken one of the disks. Impossible. Impossible? Thought Igorov. He had known Volodya Korchnoi for nearly 25 years, ever since the academy. Korchnoi had proved himself to be a superlative operations officer, adept, bold, cunning, the sort of man who could, in theory, excel as a clandestine asset for the CIA and survive the dangers. His foreign assignments, moreover, would have presented many opportunities to connect with the Americans. Impossible, he thought. Nasiryenko would be spluttering for months, more names, more mewling explanations, more temporizing delays. Igorov would raise the idea of Korchnoi with Zhuganov, but there was no time now. The American Nash was the key. His niece was already on her way to Greece. They would see how things turned out. Dominika marveled at the white light in the Athens air. Rome's sunlight was golden, softer. This Aegean light weighed down on you. The buildings reflected it. The black roads shimmered in it. Downtown traffic, taxis, trucks, and motor scooters poured in a liquid mass to part like waves against a spile, around Syntagma Square and the House of Parliament, to recede down smaller streets toward the Plaka. Dominika left her hotel and walked downhill through the buzz of Ermu Street, past shops with 2-story displays of lighting fixtures, sports bags, and fur coats. Mannequins in white fox stoles stared back at her, signaling her with tilted heads and segmented wrists. "Be watchful," they said. Dominica worked the street hard, crossing in mid-block, entering doorways, using the mirrors in the shops and in the sunglasses stores to categorize elements on the street. Short, dark, sleeveless, mustache, dusty rubber sandals, flicking dark eyes. She smelled roasted popping chestnuts, heard the twang of a wheeled barrel organ on the corner. Look for the foreign face, the blue eyes, the Slav cheekbones. Look for the brown bloom, the yellow, the green, the signals of danger, deceit, or stress. Dominica was dressed in a blue cotton dress with a square neck and black sandals. She carried a small black clutch bag and wore round sunglasses with black frames. An inexpensive wristwatch with a black face and a simple link band was on her left wrist. She wore her hair up, cooler in the mid-morning heat, a blue-eyed Russian doing counter-surveillance before meeting a member of the opposition. Dominica turned off Ermu onto a side street, passing tiny storefronts displaying religious vestments, golden cassocks, stoles, and mitres. Silver pectoral crosses hung on heavy chains and rotated slowly in the display windows. She was alone on these side streets, alone after one, two, three turns. Ahead of her was the little Byzantine chapel of Kapnakaria, sunken in the middle of Ermu Street, broad brick and slit windows and sloping tile roof. Dominica crossed the street, went down five steps, the level of the street in A.D. 1050, and entered the chapel. The inky interior of the church was minuscule. Frescoes and icons in the ceiling arches were chipped and water-stained. The spidery Byzantine letters came off as pale red to her, faded as if by eons of candle smoke and incense. Near the door was a sand table with long orange tapers, some tilted against each other. Dominica took a candle out of a nearby stack and lit it with the flame of a candle already burning in the sand tray. Before she could seat the bottom of the candle into the sand, a hand appeared and tipped another wick to the flame of her candle. Dominica looked around and saw Nate standing close behind her. He had a wry expression on his face, and the purple halo around him made him look like one of the Byzantine saints on the peeling frescoes. He put his finger to his lips, gestured with his head, and slipped out the door. Dominica waited a moment, planted her candle in the sand, turned, and went out into the white sunlight and city noise. Nate was standing across the street, and Dominica went over to him. He was very proper, businesslike, the case officer meeting his asset. Dominica remembered the intimacy of Rome the time before, and of Helsinki earlier. They had been lovers apart from the spying, something vital and edgy and true. For Nate, the memory of them was more complicated. He had slept with his agent. He was risking his career, her safety, an enormous misstep. He had been warned by Forsyth and Gable, men he respected, yet he made love to her again in Rome, helpless to stop, and with the transcendental Benford in the next room. He had died a little inside when she had been recalled to Moscow, and he blamed himself for what she had had to endure. Now they had a mission to complete, and there was a line of dew on her upper lip, and he wanted to reach out and touch her. Dominica knew it, too, with the clarity of a synesthete. She stood apart from him, not offering her hand, watching his eyes, the purple in the air around his head. She knew he wanted her to be his asset, his source, his agent. But they were more than that. He wouldn't budge, so she was determined to remain professional. They stood there in the drubbing sunlight for a second, then Dominica said, "Shall we go?" And she followed him as he turned to walk up the street. They meandered down narrow alleys into the heart of the Plaka, turning left, then right on a seemingly aimless course, a route that would force any coverage to close up in the maze of passageways and courtyards and little open squares ringed by shops. Music drifted out of stores, yellow sponges threaded together and lumpy ropes draped the doorways. The peppery perfume of incense and sandalwood drifted in the air. Automatically, Nate stole glances over Dominica's shoulder. She fluidly looked past his ear to check the other side of the street. He caught her eye, and she shook her head slightly.
Nothing that I can see.
He nodded his agreement. As dusk fell, they walked slowly around Platia Filimusen, ringed with chairs and canopies and umbrellas, crisscrossed overhead by strings of light bulbs. Dishes clattered from the kitchens of the restaurants. Nate guided Dominika around a corner to a worn green door in a wall. A small placard beside the door read, Taverna Zinos. They sat at a corner table in the gravel garden and ordered taramo and beet greens and papuzakia, sautéed eggplant stuffed with ground lamb, cinnamon, tomatoes, and bechamel baked golden brown. Heads together, they talked quietly about the script that Dominika would play back to Moscow. They agreed that she would report to the center that she had seduced him, and he avoided her eyes for a second. She would report that he was starting to talk about his work, the clever little sparrow winding up her target. They had 2 days to create the legend, stay away from her hotel room, watch for surveillance. There would be no contact whatsoever with the station. You will never guess who is in Athens, said Nate, filling Dominika's glass with retsina from a battered aluminum pitcher. Forsyth arrived 2 months ago. He's chief here now. Dominika smiled. And Bratok, has he followed him? She asked. She wondered if they knew of their secret affair. Gable? Yes, they're inseparable, said Nate. Conversation stalled. They looked at each other in silence. There was a heaviness in the air, a weight on their heads. Nate looked at Dominika and his vision dimmed around the edges. We have 2 days, Nate said. It is important we go through the act. We need to fill the days. We must carry on the actual conversations. We must actually say the things I report to the center. Everything must be, how do you say, podlinni, said Dominika. Authentic, said Nate. We have to appear authentic. It is important for me to live the details now for when I report back, she said, remembering the interrogations in Lefortovo. Then they had little more to say. They both were leaden with a lie, with a denial of their passion. His purple cloud never changed as if he felt no conflict. Dominika closed her mind to him. They were walking again, skirting the margins of the Plaka along the narrow, dark side streets hard against the Acropolis walls. They went quietly up a narrow staircase with flower pots on each step. At the top, Dominika put her hand on his arm to stop. They stood in the shadow, looking down, listening in the night for the sounds of footsteps. It was still, and Dominika took her hand off Nate's wrist. Decision point, whispered Nate. Do we split up, go to our hotels, meet early tomorrow? She didn't want to make it easy for him. What if my room is monitored? You would be expected to take me to your hotel, and I would be expected to accept. Nate fought the sensation of sliding headlong into frigid water. In the interests of authenticity, of cover, that would be right. Authenticity. They looked at each other for a minute. Shall we go? Asked Nate. As you wish, she said. Sergei Maturin stood naked in front of a full-length mirror in his room at the King George Hotel in Syntagma Square. He knew Dominika was staying at the Grand Britannia next door, both venerable jewel-box hotels of old-world elegance amid the discordance of the city. Maturin did not look at his body, crisscrossed with scars from combat in Afghanistan, or at the dimpled hole in his right shoulder where he had been wounded in the bazaar in Ghazni while leading a sweep with his Alpha group. He concentrated instead on a regime of movements in slow motion, strikes, blocks, pivots, and traps. Apollyon performing Tai Chi as the noise of the evening traffic roared outside his window. He bent at the waist, then straightened, his milky eye frozen in its socket, and took a deep breath. He turned, picked up his small roller valise, and flipped it face down on the bed. He twisted 4 set screws in the metal frame of the suitcase to unlock a tubular concealment cavity developed by the technical branch, a and drew out his 2-foot-long Kyber knife with its gently curved hilt. He returned to stand in front of the mirror and went through a combat drill of cuts, parries, and slashes. The knife whistled as he swung it in a backhand cutting blow. Maturin's body glistened from his exertions. He sat down on a Louis Couture's chair, his sweat staining the powder-blue brocade. He picked up a large ceramic ashtray embossed with the King George crest and turned it over. Maturin stropped the blade of his knife along the unglazed ceramic base, heel to tip, heel to tip. The metronome rasp of steel on ceramic filled the room, drowning out the sound of the street. In a while, satisfied with the killing edge, Maturin put down the knife and dug a small zippered pouch out of his suitcase with the word insulin printed on the leatherette side. He shook 2 thick epidermic auto-injector pens from the pouch, one yellow, the other red, field syringes designed to be injected into the thigh muscle or the buttocks. The yellow pen contained SP-117, a barbiturate compound designed by Line S. That would be for questions. The red pen from Laboratory 12 contained 100 milligrams of pancuronium, which would paralyze the diaphragm in 90 seconds. That would be for after. 2 pens, the gold and red of Spetsnaz. They took a taxi in silence to Nate's hotel, the St. George Lucabatus, nestled among the pines of Licavitos Hill. From the soaring balcony they could see the spotlighted Parthenon, and the flat sprawl of city lights winking all the way to the horizon, and the black strip of the sea, and the harbor lookout where Aegeus waited for a ship with white sails. Dominica peeked into the bathroom, switching the light on, then off. They kept the rest of the lights off. The ambient light from the hotel's facade was enough. Nate paced a little in the dark room, and Dominica, arms crossed, looked at him. "If you are reconsidering our plan," she said, "I can report that my visit to your room lasted 4 minutes and tell them your ardor was somewhat, how do you say, ukorchivat kratki," asked Dominica. "Abbreviated," said Nate. His color flared at the jibe. "Yes," said Dominica, going to the other set of balcony doors and looking out. The readers at Yasenyeva would be delighted by the gossip that CIA officers' endurance is lacking. Your prowess would be well known at our headquarters. "I've always loved Russian humor," said Nate. "It's a shame there's so little of it. But in the interest of protecting our operational legend, I think you should stay overnight." In the interest of our operational legend, thought Dominica. "Very well, I will sleep on this divan, and you will sleep in the bedroom, and you will keep the door closed." Nate was matter of fact. "I'll bring you a blanket and a pillow," he said. "We have a long day tomorrow, doing nothing." Dominica did not slip out of her dress until Nate had gone into the bedroom and closed the door. Another moon, she thought sourly. It shone through the open balcony door. She got up to draw the gauzy curtains, but stopped and lay back down, letting the moonlight wash over her, paint her silver. She was tired of being used like a pump handle by all of them. The Vlasti, the interiors of the former Soviet Union, General Korchnoi, the Americans, Nate, telling her what was expedient, indicating what had to be done. How had Korchnoi done it for so long? How long could she last? She listened for Nate in the bedroom beyond the door. She needed something more from them all. She was wary of having her feelings denied to her. Nearly 0300 and Nate dully registered the door to his room opening. A diffused orange glow from the street lamps came through the sheer curtains. He turned his head slightly and saw Dominica's silhouette, that unmistakable catch in her graceful stride, move across the bedroom to the window. She reached out and drew the shears open, first one side, then the other, until she stood backlighted against the sliding glass door, which she slid open. The night air wafted the curtains out and back, snaking on either side of her, around her, over her face and across her body. She walked toward him, the curtains parting, and stood at the side of the bed. Nate propped himself up on one elbow.
"Are you all right? Is there anything wrong?" he asked.
She did not reply and stood still, looking down at him. The case officer in him instantly wondered whether she had heard something, some noise at the door. Did they have to bug out of the hotel right now? He had checked the back stairwell earlier that evening. Still, Dominica did not reply, and Nate sat up, reached out to take her hand softly in his.
"Tommy, what is it? What's going on?"
Her voice was a whisper.
"When we have made love, did you report it to your headquarters?"
"What are you talking about?" said Nate. "In Helsinki and in Rome, when we were lovers, did you tell your superiors?"
"What we did was against the rules, unprofessional. It was my fault. We risked your security, the operation."
She was silent, looking down at him. It was another second before she spoke.
"The operation," Dominica said. "You mean we risked the continued collection of Razvedka, the intelligence?"
"Look," said Nate. "What we did was crazy, both professionally and personally. We nearly lost you. I thought about you all the time. I still do."
"Of course you think about the case, about Dominica, the national asset."
"What are you talking about? What do you want me to say?" said Nate.
"I want to feel that sometimes we leave the operation behind, that there is just you and me."
Her bosom heaved in her brassiere. He stood up and put his arms around her. His mind was a riptide of damage control battling the stirring of his passion for her. He smelled her hair and felt her body.
"You gonna slip a third time, Mr. Case Officer?" he thought.
"Dominica," he said, and the rushing in his ears started the old danger signal.
"Will you break your rules again?" she asked.
She saw his purple lust. It lit up the darkened room.
"Dominica," he said, staring into her eyes.
Her lashes caught some of the light from the window. He saw Forsyth's face floating in the air above his head, scary, unblinking. He wanted her more than his power to resist, more urgently than it was possible to think.
"I want you to violate your rules with me. Not your agent, me," said Dominica. "I want you to violate me."
The lace of her brassiere rustled as she unclasped it. They fell onto the bed, and she was on her stomach, and she pulled Nate on top of her, heavy and hot, his lips at her neck, his fingers twined in hers. She held his hands tight. He fumbled. She teased him, and he trapped her hips with his legs, and her breath came up sharp. She groaned,
"Tranni menya,"
and reached behind to touch him while he whispered in her ear,
"How many rules will you force me to break?"
She looked back at him wordlessly to see if he was mocking her.
"Shall I break 5 regulations? 10?
He kept his mouth close to her ear and began counting to 10 slowly, matching the numbers with the cadence of his hips.
"Odin, diva, 3.
She was trembling, but at a different hertz rate than before.
"Chetiri, piat, shist."
She stretched her arms out, gathered fistfuls of bedsheet.
"Siem, vosiem, diavyet."
Fingers like claws, she twisted the sheets around her wrists.
"Dievets, 10,
said Nate, lifting himself off her back, hotly connected yet soaring above her glistening spine, and suddenly the gentle line of her back and buttocks arched, and she buried her face in the mattress, mouth gasping. The bar of moonlight inched across the room, and they watched it as they lay next to each other. Nate leaned over and held her chin in his hand, kissed her on the lips. She took his hand away gently.
"If you say the wrong thing," she said, "I will put my thumbnail in your right eye and tip you over the balcony railing."
"I have no doubt you could do it,"
said Nate as he lay back against the pillow.
Yes, Nate, Dominica said. And if I need anything more, your little sparrow will lure you into bed again.
Okay, okay, that's not what I meant. Can we get a few hours of sleep? Will you be still for a while?
Konishna, of course. Good agents always follow instructions, said Dominika.
Taverna Zinos Papuzakia, stuffed eggplant. Brown ground lamb with diced onions and peeled diced tomatoes in olive oil. Season well, let cool, and add grated cheese, parsley, soaked day-old bread, and beaten egg. Halve eggplants lengthwise and sauté in oil until soft. Scoop out eggplants, reserve the flesh, and fill cavity with meat mixture. Top with Mornay sauce, drizzle with oil, and bake in dish with chopped eggplant, flesh, and minimal water in the bottom, until tops are golden brown. Serve at room temperature. Chapter 37. Zhuganov gripped the receiver of the encrypted phone tightly. The instrument was as big as his head. Of course they will be looking for surveillance, Zhuganov said. You'll never be able to follow them. Stay with your original plan. Do you have the materials prepared? 15 minutes will be all you need. One name, confirm it, then the killing stroke. Zhuganov swiveled in his chair. Look, I'm not telling you not to save her, but the name is more important than anything, than anyone. Panemat. Understand? I'm waiting for results, and keep your mouth closed. Out. Their last day in Athens, the sun hot at 9 a.m., both of them feeling tired and unplugged and drifty. They walked from the hotel down Pindaru, stopped for a fresh-squeezed orange juice in Kalanaki Square, sat elbow to elbow under a canopy as the waiter brought a pastry. They would stay on the move throughout the day, continue to rehearse how Dominika would report the contact to the center. Dominika took a bite of the flaky roll and licked her fingers. She was feeling better and made an effort. Shall I tell them you forced me or that I blindfolded you and locked you naked in an armoire? She tore a piece of brioche and tried feeding him. He moved his head away. The center would probably understand stuffing someone into an armoire, Nate said. He felt scratchy and irritable and guilty, no patience with morning after love talk. Dominika's face fell when he said that. She put the brioche down on the plate. Well, that is bistashini, she said, turning to face him, heartless, soulless. But Nate's contrarian demons already had their hands in his guts, and he knew his feelings for her, but he knew his duty, and he knew what she wanted, and he knew what he could give, what the CIA would let him give, and that he had let his passion, oh, it was real passion, no doubt, take over again, again, goddammit, on the day before she was supposed to return to Moscow and sit in front of the interrogators. And if she wasn't pitch perfect, well, that would be his fault because he couldn't tell her no last night. Romantic, hopeless Russians. She wanted some sort of romance, but they were both intel officers and there couldn't be any distractions. He looked at her. His last thought was that he probably loved her. But she saw the demons, read the purple bloom around his shoulders, and knew the connection of last night was gone. She saw his guilty regret and the washed-out color around him. Her own demons flew out of the cave like bats at sunset, and she became Igorova, feeling the anger building, the goryachnost, the temper that General Korchnoi had warned her about. She stood up. I'm going back to my hotel for a shower and change of clothes, she said. Negative, said Nate, slipping into agent handling mode. It's the one place they can find you, and us. Benford definitely said, Gospodin Benford might do without a wash and a change, I cannot. I will take 10 minutes. Nate did some fast calculations. Stick with her? Cut her loose and meet her later. He had seen her face, knew the signs, she was furious at him. It would be best not to let her alone. she might disappear out of spite. Some report that would make back in Langley.
Okay, 10 minutes, no longer, said Nate, taking her arm. She smoothly took it away.
The Grand Britannia Hotel stood in the sunlight of Syntagma Square, gilt railings and wrought iron porte-cochere glinting in the white light. Upstairs, Nate stood awkwardly in the huge sitting room with elegant groupings of tables, chairs, and lamps, a thick Wilton underfoot. He looked into the bedroom as Dominica shrugged off her dress. He remembered the black lace bra and panties. And she bent to pull off her sandals, turning to face him, a defiant lingerie model against the backdrop of the massive silk headboard of the bed. Her semi-nakedness whipped at his senses, and she knew it. She could read him. She took a provocative step forward into the living room. "Do I distract you?" she said, lifting her arms. She was seething.
"Dominica, stop it," said Nate.
"Please tell me," she said, pulling the cups of her bra tight.
"Do I disorient you? Is the plan working?"
"Admirably, I cannot think that you could do your duty any better, Corporal Igorova," said Sergei Matarin, stepping out of the walk-in closet between the bedroom and the bathroom. He spoke Russian that sounded like a truck transmission filled with gravel. He was dressed in a dark sport coat, black shirt and slacks, and wore slip-on moccasins. He casually tossed a zippered pouch and a black cloth sheath onto the bed and began shrugging out of his sport coat, never taking his eyes off Nate. Black. Silence, then electric shock and no hesitation, not a second, as the scraps of black lace launched at Black, her arms around his neck, a knee driving into his crotch. Nate noticed ballet muscles in her legs and her buttocks bunching as Black grunted and pushed her chin back and punched her in the throat, a killing blow, and she fell back on the rug in her lacy undergarments gasping. Nate needed more time to get there in slow motion, thinking, someone's going to have to die, dead as in killed, because Black had heard them talking, and they were a cell phone call away from meltdown, and he put his shoulder down and smelled ammonia and drove the thin body back against a little Heppelwhite in the corner, which made a crack when it splintered. They both pushed off the floor and 3 stones hit the side of Nate's face, bang, bang, bang. Oh, fuck. Spetsnaz open hand technique. And he locked the ropey arm and kicked behind the knee, and Black fell and rolled and popped back up, cloven hooves high and smiling. Nate felt for a piece of furniture and slung it at Black's feet, then stepped in to smell the ammonia again, and he started low and brought the heel of his hand up and through the chin, trying to remember other long-ago hand-to-hand techniques as Black rolled again and reached the bed and pulled the whispered sheath off, and the blade was up. And the point was making little circles, and it was time to back away, seriously, because this was no good, and there were no weapons immediately at hand, nothing long enough and hard enough to deal with this bastard and the silver edge of the otherwise blue-mottled steel. The windpipe strike had not killed her, as there were black lace panties and black lace cups holding the big blue and white vase. Ming, Limoges, Wedgwood, whatever, smashing it between Black's shoulder blades in a shower of shards, and he went down on one knee, but there was the whistle of the spinning slash, and the blood started, a thin line on her thigh and diagonally across her belly, and she was red and slick, and she staggered back and fell with a bump, sitting up and looking at her legs, one wet, the other dry. The brass lamp felt good to Nate and heavy enough to throw, but Black's backhand parry was a blur. But at least it got him off her, and he closed with impressive speed, more like gliding, really, and Nate stepped inside the point of the blade, and he felt cool air on his arm and on his stomach, where his shirt split open, then hot blood running down under his belt and down the front of his legs like pissing himself, and the motherfucking sword was the real issue. So he held the brocade chair like in the circus, and the other sleeve of his shirt opened up, and the hot blood pooled in his hand, and the point of the blade caught in the brocade of the chair. And he stepped in, not much more time on the clock, he reckoned, and tried to torque Black's knee with legs that were losing strength, bad sign, very bad,
like his red footprints on the carpet and the smell of copper in the air. Dominica looked at them across the room, Maturin moving easily, swinging his Kyber knife, and Nate staggering sideways, sodden clothes red from the chest down.
"My fault. Coming back here, Idiotka. He's going to fight until he dies," she thought. "He's fighting for me, and the rush of realization. He does love me. He is buying me time." And the Goryachnost, the rage, picked her up off the floor, and she limped and weaved in an S to the bed and picked up the black pouch. She was looking for a weapon, any weapon. Black was breathing easily through his nose, and Nate could feel something come loose as the blade ran across his biceps, and he grabbed the blade and felt it slide across his palm and through his fingers, like a wet knife through a birthday cake. Black stood looking at him, and Nate concentrated on locking his weak knees so he wouldn't fall. This Spetsnaz guy, no doubt, was savoring the next cut, thought Nate, an upward rip to spill his long intestines on the Wilton or the backhand strike at the side of his neck. Then Liberté came over the ramparts like something out of Delacroix, with one breast out of her bra, and she drove the red and yellow pens into his buttocks, and his instinctive back fist knocked her down, head bouncing hard, but Black started melting and rasping, great heaving breaths on hands and knees, and red and yellow tails pinned on the donkey, and he crawled toward the knife but was slowing down, crawling in slow motion and shaking his head from side to side, with an archetized diaphragm and a skull full of barbiturates, and the good eye rolling up into his head, and the heels drumming on the pink and blue carpet, and the death rattle, and, let's seriously consider, sawing off his head just to be safe. But Nate's hand was under Dominica's left breast, and he was glad of the fluttering heartbeat. Her eyes opened, and he started to lay his head on the softness but remembered something important. He couldn't go to sleep just yet. He had a call to make. Dominica had taken the phone from Nate's nerveless fingers and told Bratok where they were, and he listened good and brought a cleared embassy medic and a trauma kit. They were waiting on the street in the car. How Marty Gable got them both cleaned up and out of the hotel was a miracle, vintage Saigon and Phnom Penh. Bedsheets became bandages. Maturin's vinegary-smelling jacket was buttoned all the way up. Dominica's hair was slicked back. Gable motioned to her to yank the pens out of Maturin's ass, sheath the Kyber blade, check his pockets. He put Nate's arm around his neck and humped him out of the service entrance, telling a limping Dominica to lock the door to the suite and throw the room key in a planter in the hallway. They collapsed in Gable's back seat like Bonnie and Clyde, and the wide-eyed medic wrapped Israeli pressure bandages around Nate's chest, arms, and hand, another around Dominica's thigh, and taped the diagonal slice across her stomach. Nate's pulse was thready from loss of blood, so the medic started an IV, and Dominica cradled Nate's head in her lap, not talking, holding the plasma bag as Gable slammed through traffic, cursing and pounding the steering wheel. They banged up the hilly streets into Sogafros, under the loom of Mount Yamitos, and Gable helped them up to a top-floor retiré in a quiet Greek apartment block where the station kept a contingency safe house. They put Nate in the small bedroom, and the medic stayed with him until the embassy doctor arrived. They were both cleared, but Gable wanted them out as soon as they finished. 20 stitches in Dominica's leg, 3 times that for Nate. Gable held Dominica by the shoulders, looking at her over the tops of his glasses, but she shrugged him off and went into another bedroom to sponge off the blood, insanely flashing to Ustinov, how long had it been? Her breaths started coming in gulps. Gable thanked the doctor and medic. They wondered what the spooks were up to but knew to keep quiet, and steered them out and gently closed the door. Dominica was in Nate's room, listening to him breathe, and Gable shooed her out. She didn't want soup, didn't want bread. She closed the door to her bedroom, but in 5 minutes Gable heard her cross back into Nate's room, and he left her alone. Later that night, Gable cracked open the bedroom door and heard her talking to him.
He was still out from the sedative, color better, and Diva sitting on the bed, talking Russian to him. Big, ugly mess, this was. But thank Christ they survived. Forsythe snuck in the next day after dark wearing a paste-on goatee and wire-rimmed glasses. Greek cops knew his face, and there was a manhunt on for the young Russian woman at the Grand Britannia Hotel, who had disappeared, leaving a man dead in her room. Dominika's passport picture was all over the television and papers. There had been another man, a dark-haired Westerner, perhaps an American. Gable told Forsythe he looked like a Viennese sex therapist in that goatee, then briefed him on the scene at the hotel, nodded to the two bedrooms and back. Forsythe sat down and threw a stack of late-edition newspapers on the coffee table. The Bloodfest at the Grand Britannia was being covered in a media firestorm excessive even by Greek standards. Station translators had provided a list of headlines. KGB slaughter plot sunders Athens calm. Katamarini, center right. Cold War massacre at Grand Britannia Hotel. Toby Ma, center. Russian beauty sought in sex murder tryst. Eleftera Topia, center left. U.S. disdain for Greek patrimony, antiques. Rizospastis, communist. Assassin picks low season at five-star abattoir. Tribuna Skiptare, Albanian language. They made a little noise in the kitchen waiting for Dominika to come out of her bedroom. A half hour later, Forsythe got up and tapped softly on her door. Through the door, she told him she wasn't feeling well. No, she didn't need the doctor, but she wanted to sleep. Forsythe came back out into the living room. I'm not sure, something wrong, more than shock, he said to Gable. Then a little stirring, and Nate shuffled in, finally awake, holding the wall, orange betadine showing around the edges of the bandages and tape. One side of his face was purple. He eased into an armchair, face wet from the exertion and pain. What are you guys doing here? He rasped. Some kind of emergency? How you feeling? Said Gable, ignoring him. Any dizziness? Have an appetite? Nate shook his head and Forsythe started talking softly. I've been on the green line with the 7th floor. I've been called in a half dozen times by the ambassador, who has himself been summoned by the Greek foreign minister twice. The entire Hellenic police is looking for a Russian woman, trying to ID the dead guy, and the Russian embassy claims to have no idea what's going on. The Greek Ministry of Foreign Affairs is just up the street from the GB Hotel, and the TV lights in Syntagma Square have been on for 24 hours.
That's the best thing about a clandestine operation, the TV lights, said Gable, looking at Nate.
Everyone at headquarters is in a different stage of pissed, seriously pissed, and fucking outrageously pissed, said Forsythe. There are recriminations flying back and forth. Why didn't we anticipate this kind of SVR action? Why didn't we yank you off the case? Why couldn't Marble warn us about the ambush? Most of it's bullshit. I received an email this morning from Chief Europe. Admiral Nelson suggested it was time to change the sails in the Diva case. Apparently, Searod told Chief Europe he had his head up his ass, in front of the director. It's all stuff we can handle. Then last night, Benford called asking whether his guidance about not going to Dominika's room was unclear. He sends his regards. Explaining your performance to him specifically is something we, you, might not handle so easily. It will depend on Benford's inclination to flog you.
I gave him my personal recommendation to do so, said Gable.
Yet there is hope. Benford says this incident has created a narrow window of opportunity. He was very excited. He's arriving late tomorrow evening, and until then he wants you to stay out of sight. Forsythe went to the sliding glass doors of the balcony and looked through a gap in the drawn curtains. It's important that Dominika stay hidden so the center keeps thinking the worst, that she's blown to the CIA, that their plot to ambush Nate is exposed. We've got a couple of days at the most. Gable got up and walked down the little hallway and knocked at Dominika's room. He spoke softly through the door, and then she told him to come in. They could hear his muffled baritone down the hall, and in 10 minutes Gable walked back out and sat down.
"Trouble," he whispered. "She's agitated, not hysterical, just pissed. Splenetic. That temper, but this time it's serious. Doesn't know who to trust, us, Marble, certainly not her own people."
Nate struggled to get up out of the chair.
"Sit the fuck down," said Gable. "Part of it is that she's frantic. She almost got you killed. First thing she asked was how you are."
"She saved my life," said Nate. "That mechanic had me cold."
"You check out the room when you went up?"
Nate avoided his look.
"Didn't think so," said Gable. "She's talking about not going back, about running away, defecting. She's shocky and betrayed, and her leg's hurting her. Poor kid. Just spent 2 days with Droopy over here."
Nate wasn't going to make things worse by telling them about the lovemaking.
Forsyth stood up.
"Marty, stay with D.Va until Benford arrives. Nate, we'll smuggle you into the station tomorrow. I want you to start writing up what happened. Benford is going to want a full readout."
Nate nodded.
"Right now, let's give her space," said Forsyth. "We may have lost her as an agent. We probably won't find out until she does some thinking." Forsyth left, and Gable got up, rattled around the kitchen, came back out to the living room, said he was going to the corner to get a bottle of wine, some cheese, and bread.
"Stay off the balcony," he said, moving toward the door.
He took a pistol out of his coat pocket, flipped it to Nate.
"PPKS," Gable said. "Lady's gun. I brought it for you."
Dominica spent most of the first night on her bed, looking at the ceiling. Then she had gone into Nate's room to sit beside the bed, watching him sleep. She knew exactly what had happened. Uncle Vanya had tired of waiting for her to elicit the information about the American mole, had dispatched Maturin to solve the problem and protect his political flank. He apparently did not care that anyone in a room with Maturin was at mortal risk. Had he intended Maturin to eliminate her too? She was not sure, but for the moment she would assume the answer was yes. Another betrayal by Vanya and a Novisanya Kuja, the dunghill of the service. She had told Bratok that she was not sure she wanted to continue spying. She was out of Russia, in the West, perhaps she would defect. Gable listened and softly told her to do what she thought was best. His aura was deep purple, and he had no reason to be so serene, but she was glad. Now it was the next night and late. The beacons on the microwave towers on the ridge of Umidos, the only pinpricks of light on the dark mass of the mountain. Forsyth and Benford sat in chairs while Dominica, in a bathrobe, lay on the couch so she could keep her leg elevated. She had heard Nate leaving the apartment earlier, but she didn't come out to see him. Nate was gone. Benford arrived late, insisting on coming straight to the safe house. He asked to read the account of the attack, said that the Office of Medical Services wanted the SVR auto-injector pens in the next pouch. In the car, he had listened to Forsyth and muttered that speed was of the essence.
"How are you feeling?" he asked her. "Can you walk?"
She stood up and walked around the couch. She ran her fingers over the stitches, same side as her broken foot. This leg was getting a lot of wear.
"Forgive me," said Benford. "I need to know you can move around because we have to go out on the street. You have to call Moscow."
Dominica winced as she sat down. Benford put a hand on her shoulder.
"Take your time. I want to talk to you first.
Domi, I need to know whether you are willing to continue the relationship we started in Helsinki. We need to know whether you're willing to return to Moscow and work from there."
"And if I am not," she asked, "what will become of me?"
She knew these men, but her trust in them, in everyone, had faded. They were professionals, they needed results, they answered to an organization that was also the opposition. Benford and Forsyth were bathed in blue, their words were tinged with it. Sensitive, artistic, devious, they would work her in layers, she knew.
Be careful.
What will become of you is that I will fly you to the United States and you will meet with the director, who will award you a medal and a bank draft with which you may buy a house in a location of your choice, subject to security review, from the comfort of which you can read about current developments in Russia and the world. You will be free of a life of secrets, of intrigue, deception, and danger. Pulsing blew out of the top of his head. Benford is so clever. I've met him once, yet he knows me, she thought. And if I elect to continue working with you, what do you want me to do? If you're in, I would ask that you make a phone call, said Benford, to your uncle. Forsythe was silent and watchful in the other chair. Steady blue, she could trust him, a little anyway. And the nature of the phone call? Asked Dominica, knowing they were leading her through one hedgerow after another. What do you want to accomplish? Forsythe told me a little about the fight in the hotel room, said Benford, and how you saved Nate's life. I want to thank you for that. He still had not answered her question. And the call to Moscow, she asked. After all this drama, we need to pave the way for your return home, and to maximize the chances that you land a good job in the center, assuming you agree to continue working. Benford pulsed blue at her. If I return, General Korchnoi will ensure that I have a good position. He and I will make a strong team. Of course, we're counting on that, said Benford. But you must operate separately. Stay in different orbits. Dominica nodded. And the day will come when you will have to carry on in his place. Dominica nodded again. But to enable all this, you have to contact Yasinyevo. An urgent call. You were worried, exhausted. You bribed someone, a veterinarian, a pharmacist, to sew up your leg. In your fatigue and anger, you discard the basic rules about speaking openly over the phone. The center's Spetsnaz assassin nearly killed you. Young Nash luckily prevailed. It's important they think Nash killed him. You are calling on the run, police on your trail, the Americans about to catch you, and you have to ask dear old Uncle Vanya to rescue you. I see, said Dominica. Gospodin Benford, are you sure you don't have a little Russian in you?
Can't imagine that I do, said Benford.
I would not be surprised, she said. There's something else you must do, said Benford. During the call, we must spread some disinformation. Do you understand the word?
Disinformatia.
Yes, said Dominica. Precisely. The operation against Nash has exploded in their faces, but you were able to coax a little out of him. What do you want me to say in this obman, this deception, said Dominica. You had an argument, still fighting the Cold War, still spying on each other. Nate blurted that a major Russian spy was just caught in the United States, an important person managed actively by the center. Is this true? Asked Dominica. This must have been the crisis for Vanya, she thought. He is now probably in serious political difficulty. Completely true and accurate, said Benford. You must tell them Nate told you the center tried misdirecting the mole hunt by indicating the spy had eye surgery. False lead. Benford paused. Excuse me, but what is the purpose of this message? Asked Dominica. She thought it strange, but could not read Benford's face. His color was fading. Dominica, the details are important. We want to let the center know that we saw through the deception. That's why mentioning the eye surgery false trail is critical, and we want the center to think you've done good work. We want them to rescue you. Is that all clear? Yes, but I will tell them I killed their assassin, said Dominica. Me, because he was going to kill us both. Now Nash has fled, and it is my uncle's Grubaya Oshibka, his blunder, not mine. Admirable, said Benford. A subtle refinement. Marble was right. She is something.
I've written down some details where you're hiding, said Forsythe. Then we can go out and make the call.
They looked over his notes, then Dominica went into the bedroom to change, leaving Forsythe and Benford alone.
"Not telling her she's pulling the trigger on the general is going to upset her," said Forsythe. "It's the only way."